IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our...
The headlines, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution highlights the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program and says a country will face a pressing need for nuclear energy in the future. In Albania, police notify the U.S. Embassy of the MKO terrorist cult's involvement in human and drug trafficking. U.S. police in New Jersey are under fire for their racially motivated response to a scuffle between two teens, one black and the other white. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half-hour, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, rejects Western claims that Iran is seeking a nuclear weapon, once again confirming that Tehran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful.
لذا شما ملاحظه کنید ببینید جبهه دشمن رو مسئله انرژی هسته‌ای ما چه تکیه ظالمانه‌ای داره میکنه. تحریم به خاطر انرژی هسته‌ای که میدونن هم صلح آمیزه. حالا اسم بیارن که این تولید بمب فلان قدر فاصله داره، حرفای مهمل و بی‌معناست. خودشون میدونن که ما دنبال این قضیه نیستیم، دنبال سلاح هسته‌ای نیستیم، ما دنبال بهره‌مندی صلح آمیز از هسته‌ای هستیم. این رو فهمیدن، تشخیص میدن، نمیخوان ملت ایران این پیشرفت بزرگ و چشمگیر علمی رو بهش دست پیدا کنه و فشار میارن.
Ayatollah Khamenei also noted that Iran will further develop its peaceful nuclear capacity to maintain its independence. Sooner or later, the leader added, the Islamic Republic will be in need of nuclear energy. Ayatollah Khamenei recalled that he had cautioned the negotiators to include certain points in the initial deal when it was being drawn up back in 2015, but that those cautions were not heeded and therefore led to subsequent problems. Iran's leader said the chief purpose of the sanctions is to weaken the Islamic Republic. He pointed out to production, collective efforts, and diplomacy as a way forward to neutralize the effects of economic pressure and sanctions. But to further delve into the comments of Ayatollah Khamenei, we're now joined by Sayyid Mostafa Khoshchesh, who is a political analyst joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, we have journalist and political commentator Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, who is joining us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Khoshchesh in Tehran. It's great to have you with us here. Let's go over some of the key points and comments mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei. He did stress once again that Tehran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful and that Iran is not seeking nuclear weapons. Help us better understand those comments.
Hello, Verdi, and thanks for having me. Well, what the Iranian leader said was reiterating, he was reiterating once again that Iran is very much resolved to maintain its peaceful nuclear program, despite the many inspections that have been carried out on Iranian nuclear, civilian nuclear industries. That included the largest number of man hours of inspections before the JCPOA and after that, of course. United States is just using Iranian nuclear order to demonize Iran without providing any kind of proof in order to advance its containment program that consists of the ultimate objective of containing Iran's power components in various areas of nuclear industry, regional power and missile power. So Iran is in the know. Iran knows what they are doing, and it wants to, you know, diffuse their containment plan if possible. If not, as the Iranian Supreme Leader reiterated, the main road towards salvation and getting rid of these pressures is diffusing the sanctions and the impact of this weapon of choice for the United States that's reinvigorating the Iranian economy. Iran has very detailed plan for developing and reinvigorating its national economy, and also through expanding ties with the regional states, with China, Russia, Latin America, Africa. And this plan has already started under the administration of President Raisi. But more interesting to me was the kind of message that he had for the current talks in Vienna.
Said Mohsen Abbas in London. The leader, he highlighted stopping economic pressure on the Islamic Republic by neutralizing sanctions and using diplomacy to remove them. However, the main issue, he said, is neutralizing them all. What can you tell us about the significance of these comments, given the timing of it all, with all the negotiations taking place to revive the JCPOA in Vienna?
Well, there are murmurs that there has been significant progress in Vienna, and the stumbling block, of course, is still the United States of America, which can't give any real pathway towards, if you like, confirming trust in its ability to actually carry through any agreement that they do even reach, because that's a fundamental problem. America walked out of this agreement without any recourse to international, norms, diplomacy, such things, and they still can't give those guarantees. If those guarantees can't be given, how on earth can the Iranians trust them again? So, Ayatollah Khamenei is absolutely right to make a point of caution for negotiators there, as well as for the Iranian people and for the world at large, to say, look, we can't just blindly go into dealing with America, given how unreliable they are in terms of delivering on anything that they promise. So that's very important. But I think it is also very important that Ayatollah Khamenei, admonishes, I think, some of the people who went headlong into trusting American negotiators and various others, these kind of things shouldn't have happened in the first place if things had been watertight, if the agreement had been actually really, really watertight in preventing America from walking out so easily. So again, that mistake can't be made once more, and the way to avoid it is absolutely correct, that you cannot rely on who is your declared enemy. I mean, America, let's face it, neoliberals, the neoconservatives, they have not changed their stance towards Iran. They are, fundamentally opposed to the Islamic revolution, to its ideals, to its establishment. They're fundamentally committed to overthrowing the establishment as it stands. And so you have to bear that in mind, that you're dealing with your arch enemy, and behind your arch enemy is an even worse enemy. The Israelis, who are nuclear militarized to the maximum, not pressured at all, are on no negotiating table to actually account for all the 400 plus nuclear arms, which largely probably pointed now at Iran itself. So where's that in the equation, in the mix? I mean, the Iranians would be perfectly within their rights to raise Israel, who is the main regional nuclear threat, to come also into the agreement. In fact, I think the Iranians are being very, very gentle with them, with the JCPOA, even as it stands, letting them very much off the hook. So I'd say Ayatollah Khamenei's cautionary note is really one to say, look, remember who you're dealing with, and make sure that you don't sell yourselves short, and you have nothing to fear, because you are in a unique position, as Iran is, to create a new kind of resistance, non-neoliberal controlled economy, and a nation that remains sovereign and independent because of that.
Back to Mr. Khoshesh. The leader, he said that his points in his speech today, he said his points were not observed initially when the JCPOA was being drawn up, and following that, problems occurred. Can you tell us what these points were?
As a matter of fact, he made 9 conditions for the Rouhani administration to show respect for these 9 red lines, or even 11 red lines. Sometimes we refer to them in more details. But the most important one was never be optimistic about the United States showing responsibility towards any kind of deal with the outside world. Never trust the United States, and never be optimistic about it. because the U.S. would withdraw from any kind of agreement, and the U.S. has proved to be irresponsible party. The U.S. believes that it's exceptional, that it's the top world nation, and they would turn the table over. And Rouhani administration didn't respect that very much. Also, the Iranian leader stressed and warned the Rouhani administration against any kind of haste. So these two eventually led up to the Obama administration defiance, actually, and non-compliance in real terms with the JCPOA undertakings, and also the Trump administration exit from the nuclear deal. And John Kerry said on NPR, the national radio of the United States, at around the same time that Trump pulled out of the JCPOA, that even if we had been in office, we would have withdrawn from the JCPOA if Iran hadn't been present in the talks over its missile program and regional power. So this is a reality. Biden administration is no shy of revealing that he means to contain all Iranian power components in these various areas. So, but by that, the Iranian leader was sending a direct message, because this team and this administration is very much, you know, from those that were critical of President Rouhani administration's policy, especially with regard to the United States and JCPOA. So they do have very much respect for these, you know, red lines. But the Iranian leader's remarks could be interpreted or implied as some kind of direct and stressed message to the United States that now that we are at very crucial moments in Vienna talks, the main challenge has arrived. The two sides are, you know, heading on towards the main peak of confrontation in this challenge of negotiations over mainly one aspect or several aspects of assurances, as well as parts of the sanctions that Iran has been requesting to be removed. The Americans are using every possible means on the political scene. One of them being the Israelis' presence in the Vienna in order to pressure Iran. One of the others is dismantling the team when Richard Nephew and some others separated from the team. These are all messages and instruments used by the United States in order to pressure Iran and send the message to Iran that these are the final moments. We are not going to withdraw. Now, Iran may not withdraw from these red lines. If the Americans really mean to have it, you know, deal, they should guarantee a lasting deal. And by that, we do not mean at all just a congressional approval, a statement, something like that. Everyone knows that John Kerry or Biden's signature and endorsement matter nothing. You know, they have already proved it. But we need them to show that they lament, that they regret what they've been doing to Iran. They say it. But they have kept the pressure intact. They continue the maximum pressure policy. They should show that they regret what Donald Trump did. And if they really want a deal, they need to show up to give the assurances and guarantees. But what Iran is looking for is a complex set of guarantees. It's not just a political guarantee that Biden or the Congress might give to Iran.
Right.
It's more than that. The inherent guarantees are more important to Iran. So the message today was exactly to the Vienna talks that Tehran may not retreat from the red lines. And the final message here is that if the United States team and the U.S. administration continue this challenge in Vienna in a way that this round of talks that was supposed to be the last round ends up in another return to the capitals, then the U.S. would regret it. Tehran would be more cautious, would be more steadfast, more resolved on its demands in the sanctions removal area and as well as in area of assurances and guarantees. So they better stick to their final chance. Okay. Because if the representatives and negotiating teams return to the Capitol, they would not earn even as much as they have so far. I mean, the Americans.
Thanks to our guest, Sayed Mostafa Khoshchesh, joining us from Tehran, and Sayed Mohsen Abbas speaking to us from the British capital, London. Elsewhere, Iran's top negotiator in the Vienna talks is calling on other parties to be realistic and avoid excessive demands. In a tweet, Ali Bagheri Kani says it's time for them to take, quote, serious decisions in order to restore the 2015 accord. The diplomat says the months-long negotiations are closer than ever to an agreement. However, he stresses that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. Russia's representative to the talks, Mikhail Ulyanov, has echoed Baladikhani's remarks, calling for final decisions to be made. Albanian police have alerted the U.S. Embassy that members of a terrorist anti-Iran group known as Mujahideen Khalq organization have been involved in various criminal activities. Albanian media reports suggest some MKO operatives based in a camp near the capital, Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 members to France. A number of them have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, and that's not all. Based on these reports, some senior MKO members have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs to Italy. Police have also prosecuted another member over theft charges. The criminal activities happened between 2019 and 2021. The terrorist organization has been involved in the massacre of thousands of Iranians, including senior officials in the 1980s. Iran says Washington and some of its allies have been supporting the terrorist group. The U.S. removed MKO from its terror blacklist in 2012. Its members now enjoy freedom of activity in the U.S. and Europe, and even hold regular meetings wherein European and American officials make speeches. Elsewhere, U.S. law enforcement is once again facing accusations of double standards. Now a video showing officers' response to fight between two black and white teens has rekindled fears of racial bias. The footage shows the teenagers are arguing in a mall in New Jersey and police arrive to break up the brawl. Officers then tackle the black boy to the ground and handcuff him while the white teen is seated on a couch and looks on. Social media users have reacted to police behavior and slammed it as racially motivated. The New Jersey governor has described the situation as racially disparate treatment by police. Anti-racism sentiments have remained high in the U.S. following several high-profile cases of police brutality against black Americans, including the murder of George Floyd in 2020. That's a wrap for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Dispossession, the great social housing swindle directed by Paul Sung. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Claudia Webb, who is a Labour Party councillor in the London Borough of Islington. Now, Dispossession is a documentary that explores the catastrophic failures by successive governments that have led to a chronic shortage of social housing in Britain. The film focuses on the neglect, demolition and regeneration of council estates across the UK and investigates how the state works with the private sector to demolish council estates to build the land they stand on, making properties that are unaffordable to the majority of people.
Mm. they're going to regenerate it, which means total demolition. And when it very first started, it was a case of nothing will happen without your approval. Well, that was lie number one on day one, and it's never changed.
We've got councils of all kinds across London who are trying to demolish traditional council estates. They're actually destroying communities.
It was Mrs. Thatcher whose right to buy scheme was a vote winner for families like the Pattersons. She gave them the title deeds to their council house. They gave her tea in return.
Don't you think this is lovely?
The right to buy was probably the most popular policy ever introduced by Conservative government.
Housing is a fundamental human need, and it's one that the market just doesn't seem to be capable of providing.
We should be building every year about 240,000 to 250,000 homes, and we're nowhere near that.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
Essentially, we've had successive governments that simply haven't seen the role for social housing, and they've been cutting it.
It's not seen as being aspirational, and aspiration is the key word.
The last 10, 20 years, housing stock that used to be here is down, it's gone.
Access to housing in Glasgow, to social housing, is nigh on impossible.
They are tearing apart our community, brick by brick, and we're not going to let them!
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a very serious problem facing this country, and it was a very moving and deeply personal documentary for the director, I believe, as he grew up on a council estate. And especially in the wake of the Grenfell Tower tragedy, this film comes at a very important time. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I was very impressed by it. I thought the first time I saw this film, I was a little bit concerned about how compacted it was, the amount of information it crams into an hour and I think 26 minutes. The second time I saw it, I was impressed by the amount of information that it did get in, the amount of ground that it covers, the fact that it covers all these issues from so many different angles. I mean, you're getting the input of the politicians who have to make the policy decisions that cause estates to be built or to be knocked down. Mm-hmm. You're also getting the input from people on the ground, residents of the estates, who have a very different take on it. So I'm a big fan of this film.
So as you say, this documentary, it was very dense, packed with information, statistics, and usually these films are quite difficult to watch. So do you think the director was successful in conveying his message then?
Yes, because in part I think that it makes its points pictorially. I mean, it is very crisply shot, and it's one of the situations where I think if we're walking down a street anywhere, this is the kind of issue that hits you smack in the face. You know, we could go for a walk around the studios here and we would see 3, 4, 5 luxury flat developments springing up everywhere, but we'd probably see more homeless people than we'd see social housing developments going up. And the film is very acutely attuned to what is actually happening at street level, and it shows you the disrepair that many estates have fallen into, and it contrasts that with the slightly sort of eerie gloom of these new developments going up that don't seem to be inhabited by anyone because no one's got the money to afford to move in there.
And Claudia, if I could turn to you now, as someone who works closely with this issue, is the social housing crisis in this country as bad as the documentary suggests it is?
Well, the documentary highlights quite well, actually, the state of play of council housing and council house in the UK, and in particular, actually, in London, and the sort of the dilemma that councils face as against the sort of the notion of community, the notion of identity, and the notion of neighbourhood, the concept of fairness. Right at the very heart of an urban inner city area, and what does a home mean? And it begins to explore what that means today, as against what it should have meant, and what we've got really in terms of what the documentary's portraying and what the film's portraying is this whole issue of council homes being sold off for profit, council land being sold off for profit, and exposing really a reality and dichotomy of huge waiting lists, homelessness, and yet council homes being sold in off a profit against that sort of waiting list, and then what happens to communities and what happens to neighbourhoods. It's a stark contrast, and the film has really brought home and brought out the realities of the dangers of making the wrong decisions.
Indeed, and this documentary, one of the key messages is that a home is a right and not a privilege.
We need to offer housing to people at lower rates than full market cost. And the way historically we've done that is we've built social housing. We've provided housing to people that the state has some direct investment in, on the premise that not everybody can afford to rent at full market cost, or indeed afford to purchase their own home.
The current government has slashed investment in social housing so much that the housing crisis can only get worse. The only solution is to invest in social housing again, both through local authorities to build council homes and through housing associations to build social homes, in the way that the post-war government invested. And they need to be homes that people can afford, not homes that are called affordable which are not.
If you build a council estate and people move in, those people pay rent to the local authority. After a few years, then the cost of building has paid for itself. Whereas if you have private rent, A, it's a lot more expensive, B, that money goes straight into landlords' pockets and doesn't get reinvested. It's a really good economic model, and it also points to the fact that housing should be a right for everybody.
In this documentary, we learn there's various misconceptions about social housing. Claudia, if I could ask you, why is there a need for social housing?
Well, social housing is really relevant in a local area where people, in a sense, can't afford to live in a home unless housing is provided that meets their ability to pay for that home. And in a sense, what we've got is a growing population and a basic need. And a basic need is a roof over your head. And if councils are deprived from building homes, then in a sense what you've got is demand outstripping supply. And really what the documentary highlighted by showing clips of Margaret Thatcher, it highlights Thatcherism and the policies of Thatcherism, which at the time
was the right to buy scheme.
Which was, one, the issue about right to buy, but two, under Thatcherism, they stopped councils from building council homes. Councils used to be a machine for council homes. So within local authorities, you not only saw the production of homes, but you also saw the architects, the builders, the quantity surveyors, all of the professional skill sets located within a council. Those skill sets have long gone.
And thank you for that point and shedding light on the need for social housing. And Mike, if I can turn to you now, we learned from the film that there are various stigmatisms about social housing. What are they? So what are some of these stigmatisms?
Well, one of the issues that the film addresses very well is the recent rise of TV shows like Benefit Street and things like that, where people who live on housing estates are, you know, it's these places are called sink estates, and you know, there's a certain stigma that goes with that. But there's a portrayal of people who live on estates as feckless and, you know, alcoholic, and, you know, someone who that's the kind of show. And these shows are very cheap to produce, like all reality TV, very cheap to produce, can get syndicated and make a TV channel or production company lots of money. What they actually give back to a society, a country, a community, very little. It's, you know, to stigmatize the people who appear on these shows and people who live on council estates in general. And I think part of that is that because these shows are made by people from outside those communities looking in. And it's often, as the film suggests, people who actually live on council estates, they have a community, they have a life there, they know where they're going, they know, you know, where their house relates to other people, the people who live next door to them. And it's not a sink estate. It's they're not circling the plug hole. You know, they're getting by. These places are functional, but they're being depicted in such a way as to suggest that they're not, and that they need knocking down.
We're going to continue this discussion in the next part.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
In his first public speech following Labour's landslide victory in 1997's general election, Tony Blair stood on the Aylesbury estate in south-east London and vowed there would be no forgotten people in the Britain his party wanted to build. 20 years later, residents of the Aylesbury might wonder what happened to New Labour's bold vision of the future. Since 2001, campaigners have fought against Southwark Council's plans to regenerate the estate. The council argued that the Aylesbury needs to be demolished due to the high cost of essential repairs. Campaigners claim that the council allowed the estate to deteriorate in order to facilitate its demise and justify a £1.5 billion redevelopment project.
So we saw Tony Blair there. And Claudia, I have to ask you, why didn't Blair fulfil his promises?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that when in 1997 Labour came into power in the aftermath of Thatcherism, in the aftermath of councils not being invested in to build council housing. And, you know, one could have wished and hoped that the new policy of Labour would have been to enable councils to build council homes again. A good council will build good quality homes, and with the resources and the investment, will invest in the stock that it has. But equally, if designs aren't right, and you know designs for their time aren't always fit for the future, and you then need to think about how do you make that housing stock work? How do you make it livable and continue to be enjoyable? But equally, what's important is, and what I fundamentally believe in, is if you are going to regenerate an estate, then what you need to bring back is council housing. You regenerate the estate to create continued council homes, and that we shouldn't need to, as councils, go into business with the private sector and sell off the land and sell off the homes for profit. And that's what councils need investment, so they don't have to do that. Maybe that they weren't presented with was the investment that was necessary to rebuild council homes rather than engage in a partnership with the private sector.
So you're saying that the Labour Party, the New Labour back then, effectively inherited this crisis. But Mike, from the documentary I get the sense that the Conservative Party are much to blame, but do Labour share as much blame also?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it recognises that this is essentially a non-partisan issue. You know, everyone, whether you're of the right or of the left, needs a roof above your head. And I think it recognises, as much as, you know, Labour and the Conservatives like to play this fun game on Question Time of blaming one another for previous policies, there is a degree to which both parties are to blame, and this is why we're in the situation that we're in now. But yes, that right to buy scheme was, although a huge success at the time, has proven to have taken so many properties out of the public sphere and put them in private hands. But I think at the same time, the film says that, you know, when Tony Blair did come into power, not enough was done to counteract that policy. It was seen as such a sort of overwhelming success. What can you do? You know, well, you could build more houses, and I think that was one of the issues that leads to the situation that we're in right now, that we simply don't have enough houses for the people who need them.
And another, I want to talk about a different aspect of the documentary now. And one of the effects of the housing crisis seems to be the dismantling of the sense of community. I get this sense from the documentary that the film suggests that there were outside parties that were directly targeting and sort of dividing the community in order to conquer it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, in some ways, what the film is talking about is the direction of the entire nation over the past 50 years. I mean, we're told very early on that a lot of social housing was built close to factories, close to industries. And of course, once those industries closed down in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the last decade or so, where do the people who live on those estates go now? You know, how do they pay their rent? And if they can't pay their rents, does someone come in and take their property away from them? So that it's raising bigger questions than just questions around housing. It's about, you know, who, you know, how much responsibility do councils have for the people who live in within their remit?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll just have to pause there again just for now. I'll let you get back to that point, Claudia.
As the estate falls into decay, I believe it was a deliberate strategy of the local authority because they saw the Elephant and Castle at the time as a prime market for real estate.
I haven't got all the details on the Hague, but my understanding is that some of the social rented properties will be built in another part of the borough. But again, it's around the fact that if we are going to take down a certain number of social rented properties, it's about making sure we're re-providing that, actually re-providing more for the same level of rent.
For the demolition of 9,000 plus council homes, and their replacement with luxury apartments costing £600,000 and £700,000 as an entry price, was their answer to the problem. That's no answer to the 9,000, 10,000 tenants that were living in secure accommodation at the time that are now dispersed across London, and many dispersed outside of London.
People who benefit from the housing crisis are, of course, property developers. They want to have the densest housing possible. And the best way to make dense housing is to build luxury apartments and to make it look like, you know, you're building a tall tower block, not to house many families as they did in the 60s and 70s, but to give a really slick community lifestyle.
Now, before we went to that clip, we were just talking about the notion of dismantling of the community by the outside parties. Claudia, did you agree with what Mike said?
Well, I mean, I have a different take on it because obviously we're in, my context is London, and I can see that in areas like Newark, in Nuneaton, for example, which had a coal industry, that if you create homes around a particular industry and then that industry disappears in terms of the mining industry, then you are left with homes and people without access to meaningful work. That's not the case in London. What you've got in London is a total land grab. It's a disgrace, really, in terms of a total land grab by big developers who are basically capitalising on the opportunity that is presented by the lack of inability of councils to build and invest in homes. The policy of not allowing councils to build homes, that is what's been problematic, because it's been over decades and not over a few years. What we have now in places like my own borough, where we have a good council that is building good quality homes, we bucked the trend and we sought to build council homes and we sought to find ways to do that and ensure that we do not sell off council land. But where we have planning, where we give planning permissions to the developers where they've got their own private land, what unfortunately has been created historically over time is the notion of poor doors. We have a policy of 50% of that must be affordable. Affordable meaning, you know, social rent properties. And what they do is they build that integral to the development, but they build it on the side or at the back, and that's where the creation of poor doors happens.
Of course,
it's
you're in Jeremy Corbyn's borough, and he's pledged to end the housing crisis. But I want to talk about this notion now in the film of social cleansing, which seems to be a contentious, controversial term, which means that low-income workers are being driven out of the capital, London, because of the soaring rents and the interests of corporations, of course, and real estate agents. What do we learn in the film about this?
The film's very good on gentrification and how neighbourhoods have changed in rapidly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, social housing is of less concern than attracting middle-class renters with lots of disposable income who can afford coffee and hummus and all the treats of living in the inner cities. But you know, there is a degree to which housing policy seems to have been skewed specifically, almost exclusively, towards that particular demographic. And of course, that, you know, drives out people who are originally living there, and you know, that's a one of the many big issues that this film addressed.
Well, part of that was, you know, the whole huge banking crisis that happened. You know, what happened after the banking crisis was in London, then London's property market was then used as the place where people invest. And so what you've got is overseas investors purchasing land and property, never ever living in those properties and creating a this and them scenarios and situations. What is a disgrace is when it's set against that. So you've already got that as a problem going on. Set against that is when councils have got land and homes in council control. What is a disgrace is councils then selling that off in some kind of partnership with the private sector.
It is such a complex issue.
It is.
And unfortunately, we're running out of time in this programme. And just final 30 seconds to Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're now in a situation where the Evening Standard can run a front page about house prices going up as though that's some great triumph. To me, it looks more and more like a tragedy, and this film absolutely reflects that.
Well, thank you very much for your time and joining the show. And I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam. In so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements, we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام في وصيته لهشام بن الحكم: يا هشام، ما قسم بين العباد أفضل من العقل، نوم العاقل أفضل من سهر الجاهل، وما بعث الله نبيا إلا عاقلا حتى يكون عقله أفضل من جميع جهد المجتهدين، وما أدى العبد فريضة من فرائض الله حتى عقل عنه.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, in his advice to Hisham ibn al-Hakam, stated, O Hisham, nothing has been bestowed upon the servants better than the intellect. The sleep of a man of intellect is better than the night vigil of an ignorant man. Every single prophet that Allah has sent down has been a man of intellect, whose intellect supersedes the labor of all diligent workers. The servant is not considered as having fulfilled an obligatory act from among the acts made incumbent by Allah until he understands it.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, when we're talking about the beautiful conversations of the infallible Imams, we cannot overlook the beautiful conversations of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam who suffered at the hands of the tyrannical government of his time. But despite his sufferings and hardships that he had to go through, we still find that he was able to put forth and give a light of guidance to all those who are searching for it, even in the present time. So in one of these conversations that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has with his companions, we find that His Eminence, Imam al-Kadhim, talks about generosity and the fact that we should have good manners. It's interesting, but we find that the infallible Imams talked about similar things one way or the other. There are certain things, certain moral ethical traits, which throughout have been spoken by them. One such trait and ethical moral trait, is that of generosity. And so when talking about the idea of generosity and having good behaviors, good manners, good akhlaq, good ethics and morals, we find that Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam in this conversation says to his companions, the generous and polite person is under the protection of Allah, and Allah does not leave that person until he himself makes that individual enter the garden of paradise. He then continues and says, Allah sends out none as a prophet except one who is generous. And my father, the divinely appointed Imam, recommended to me generosity and good manners. Dear brothers and sisters, it's interesting. We get so many different lessons and pieces of advice from this conversation. One of the most amazing things that we learn here is that the generous person and the polite person is under the protection of the Almighty Allah. And can there be a protection greater than that of the Almighty Allah? And so when we are generous and we are polite and we have good manners with our fellow brothers and sisters, then the protection of Allah is with us. And not only that, but Allah guides us and makes us enter the gardens of paradise. Because of what? Because of generosity and because of being polite. And finally, one of the qualities and characteristics of the messengers sent by Allah is that they were generous. If we inculcate generosity and politeness in our daily lives, can you imagine how beautiful this world would become? Can you imagine how perfect this world would become if only we follow these pieces of advice and this wisdom given to us by the infallible Imams? This is Dialogue. Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Someone by the name of Al-Amiri, he would walk past the Imam in Medina, he would curse the grandson of Rasulullah and his father. To the extent that the companions next to Imam Musa ibn Ja'far would say, Ibn Rasulullah, let us deal with him. Imam says, leave him to me, I will deal with him my way. A few days later, he goes to his farm, to the farm of this man by the name of Amiri. He sits inside the farm. One narration says that he was on a donkey. The donkey steps on some of the crops. The man is even further angered. He looks at Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and says to him, how dare you spoil my crop? Imam says to him, how much did you spend in order for your farm to be in this present state? He said, 100 dinar. He said, how much do you expect to get yearly from the selling of the crops of this particular farm? He said, 200 dinars. Imam alayhi salam, after joking with him, after making him at ease, the narration tells us, he picks up 300 dinars and says to him, here, this is for you. This man is mesmerized. All this time, this individual abusing and hurting the grandson of Rasulullah, yet Imam al-Kadhim responds back through generosity, through forbearance, through kadhm al-ghayz, not only kadhm al-ghayz. And at that moment, the man falls onto the feet of the Imam and says, Allahu ya'alamu haythu yaj'alu risalata. Allah knows whom he would make his representative on this earth. He then goes back to his companions and he finds that this man Al-Amiri is with Imam Al-Kadhim walking and chatting and smiling. The companions are amazed. They are wondering what has happened. Imam alayhi salam says to them, did I not tell you that leave him to me? And then he would recite the following verse. لا تستوي الحسنة ولا السيئة ادفع بالتي هي أحسن فإذا الذي بينك وبينه عداوة كأنه ولي حميم. Allah gives us a constitution for akhlaq.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.